This is CliffCentral.com.
Do you want to know about Rich Mulholland's new book? Rich joins us every Monday on CliffCentral.com for what we call the reality check. He's got a book out called Legacide.
Oh.
Why legacy thinking is the silent killer of innovation. Should we bring him in here?
Oh, yeah.
Busy talking to, oh, God.
Politicians often talk about legacies, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
And they're not very innovative.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is a great book. By the way, I've made my way through this book. It was one of the easiest reads I've ever picked up because, first of all, it is short. There are just over 100 pages, 124 to be exact, which is – people are busy. They don't have time to read encyclopedias. There's so much stuff that's vying for your attention these days. It's very difficult for you to dedicate more than 124 pages worth of reading to anything. So I've got to congratulate Rich, first of all, on making it fascinating. It's a great book. It's well laid out. It's illustrated. It's got really, really simple, sensible things in it that, honestly, I think this is almost like a crash course in being a better human. And that's quite a thing. There are not a lot of books that could teach you that.
Rich, you should get that on the back. Crash course in being a better human being. Gareth Cliff.
Done.
That would look good.
Absolutely done. I'm like sending a message to Taryn right now, like for the next version. I love it. Thank you very much.
How are you, you son of a bitch?
I'm really good, man. Jeez, I'm so inspired by the guy, Hans.
Yeah, from Oh God.
Mm-hmm. Jeez, so
why
inspired.
Are you inspired by him? Because you're a non-believer?
No, I was inspired by the line that said, I never wanted to grow up and have to face my kids and say I did nothing. And I think that as a value, that's something that I take away. Take out the subject choice altogether. And I want to feel that if it comes down to it at a later stage, my children can never ask me, and on any topic, why did you know something but didn't stand up for my rights on this issue?
Or why did you lie to me?
Or why did you lie to me? And, you know, I was actually saying, so I follow the Santa Claus rule around the, you know, I'll lie up until they believe a certain thing. And then I certainly.
You have to abdicate eventually.
Yeah, yeah,
say,
exactly.
All right, look, you know, that
But I was deeply, deeply inspired by it. I think it's a very, very important journey.
All right. Now you've done a lot in your life. Why did you decide to write a book?
I actually wanted to write fiction originally. I wanted to write a book called Rumor Hazard, a thriller about guys who start, to start rumors for a living.
Yeah,
it was way back when, like, there was no Twitter or social media. There was just blogging, and I was at the Offspring concert, and the guy before Offspring, the support act, it's that guy from Springbok Nude Girls. I can't remember his
Arno
name.
Arno Costens.
No, I'm not a fan. I'm a punk rock guy, and I was so offended that he was a support act, and I started thinking about ways to discredit. And I'd wanted to see the Offspring for so long, and I'd taken my whole company there that night. Mm-hmm. And then while I was listening to Arno Costens, I had this idea for a book, and I left the concert and I started writing it. And I left and I sit there and I started writing away. I went straight home. I missed the Offspring altogether, and I wrote and I started writing this thriller, and I was so excited until I wasn't anymore. And
how many pages did you get to?
I mean, I've got it on my phone right now, maybe 50.
Oh wow.
Yeah,
you can ever pick that up?
The whole premise thing. So, funny enough, I still think it was quite relevant. The basic understanding and was that the basic message was this group of professional rumor mongers. You hire them and they spread rumors about somebody having an affair or some kind of thing.
Oh, it's called Bell Pottinger.
Yeah, exactly. And but there are these youngsters, and they would get hired and to do these things. And then they were hired by a pharmaceutical company to spread rumors of a disease. And then, of course, this pharmaceutical company came out with this cure. And the first half of the book is them spreading it and how they intricately get into society and create panic. And the second half of the book is them using their skills when the pharmaceutical company tries to kill them. And that was the whole kind of premise and things.
I'm unhappy with your microphone.
Sorry.
No, it's not you. Yeah, please. There's something wrong with that mic.
Let's swap.
Yeah, swap microphones. Yeah. This is going to drive me crazy. Sorry, Rich.
No.
Try to keep things together here. So sometimes it doesn't.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
Much better.
See,
what is wrong with that inferior microphone? Has someone been using it for anal play? What's been going on here?
I mean, every time you're not here on Monday, you should have seen them.
Yeah. Oh.
They were using it for anal play.
If that's been used for anal play, we got to call John Dean because that would be a big arsehole. Remember his video from Friday? The difference between a small and a big arsehole? This is on the upper spectrum.
Okay. All right, so Rich, this book is basically a guide to how we innovate rather than we continue to perpetuate dumb, outdated ideas.
Right. And in fact, it's my premise is that it's not so much about innovation itself. I think innovation is a byproduct of a certain mindset. And it's the idea of being okay with letting go of old ideas. That's the whole thing, that an idea served its purpose up until a point, and we have to be completely okay with letting go of that idea. The last interview being, I guess, case in point in that.
Yeah, like Father Christmas.
Right, exactly.
It's fine until you're about 10. Then you've got to stop. You've got to put away, in the words of Jesus, childish things.
Right, but now also you go and you solve a problem. So you were in radio. Mm-hmm. And you were in commercial radio, mm-hmm. and you wanted to solve a specific problem, get a message out there and do it in a certain way. And I'm not saying you were wrong for all those years you spent in radio. No. I'm saying that there was a point where it was no longer right for what you were trying to achieve. And Legacy is continue doing something because it was at one stage correct. Because something was absolutely correct at one stage, the act of continuing to do that is what I see as Legacy. The idea of turning around and saying is, I wasn't wrong, I'm just no longer right, and there's a better way. That's what I wanted to talk to. What is the mindset that creates that thinking?
Well, that's the way you think. And I think a lot of other people want to be able to think like that. That's why we do the reality check with you every Monday. And you bring in diverse and varied points of view about a lot of different stuff in the world. But in your own life, did you find that you were committing legacide sometimes?
Absolutely.
I mean, it has to come from some personal experience. You wouldn't write this book if it was just some abstract thing.
So, I mean, there's two things. Obviously, I'm a prime culprit of it. The book is, I mean, the irony is a bit of Cobbler's Children there. I'm still struggling with it. I still own a presentation business making PowerPoint presentations, solving a problem that I set out to solve in 1998. Now, I could argue that the problem to some degree still exists, but is the way that I'm solving the problem still the most relevant? If I started out trying to solve the same problem today instead of in 1998, would I solve it the same way? And it's absolutely no. So I'm suffering legacy myself.
Right.
But we ran a business called 21 Tanks. It's now actually part of Missing Link. And it was a perspective lab. It was the idea that we would try and solve people's problems using our outsider's perspective. And what we found is that I thought it was going to be this amazing innovation engine where we're coming up with all these new ideas. And then I realized that innovation doesn't happen when you start doing something new. Innovation happens when you stop doing something old. So it was almost observational that I kept on seeing, well, hold on a second. We think we're trying to start something, but we're actually trying to just change the way they think. It's not about going forward. It's often about taking them a few steps back and turning off a few switches. And once I realized that, and I think it was in a lab one day, I coined this term about this legacy thinking that's killing your innovation, that I realized, hey, there's something there. And the book, I mean, I can explain the concept of legacy to somebody in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a lot of concepts in there that are loosely tied into legacy thinking or to change the way that you previously would have thought about something. So it's a bit of a brain dump. I mean, I think I'm quite cheeky in calling it a whole book. It should maybe be legacy and other stories.
Yeah, but I think for a lot of people, this is what holds them back. There are so many people who are still held captive to what happened to them in the past, the way that they were raised, the things that they were told were important that aren't important anymore, but that they still hold on to. You know, this is the definition of like those people who go through rituals that they no longer need to observe, that are taking up valuable time and necessarily switching off things that they ought to be open to.
Yes, but this is also part of your survival instinct, right? So what happens is if we had to keep on relearning every day everything that we'd already done, we'd never advance.
Mm.
So the idea is yesterday you learned something, you put it into play a few times, and now today you don't have to think about it. It kind of happens mindlessly. And
you create those neural pathways.
100%. And for the most part, it's those neural pathways that allow you to advance and grow. The problem is, what happens when one of those neural pathways you went down one day is no longer the best path? What happens if that's no longer the best way to get somewhere? And how do we create a state of mind that allows us to observe that? And to me, it comes down to asking yourself better questions. And it's so simple. I mean, the two questions. The whole book could have been two questions. What problem were you setting out to solve? Or three questions. What problems were you setting out to solve?
Mm-hmm.
Is it still a problem? If the answer is no, it's actually no longer a problem. Again,
move on.
Yeah, move on. Move on. You've done it. Well
done.
Get
a massage.
High five yourself because you fixed it. You set out to fix something and you did.
Yeah.
Let it go. But let's say you turn around and say yes. So is presentation still a problem? Yeah, absolutely. People are still shit, and when they stand up in front of audiences, they're still often terrible.
Mm-hmm.
However, then you ask yourself the second question. If you started solving that problem today, would you solve it with the same tools you did back then? And if the answer is yes, carry on. If the answer is no, change. And you have to constantly be asking yourself those questions. That's the only way you say legacy thinking.
Sia was in a, you were in a meeting with me a while ago. And we set up a meeting. You say it's an hour. So
right.
you take an hour in your calendar. And a lot of people feel they need to fill that hour up. Mm-hmm. I was sitting in a meeting with him not so long ago. We had a bunch of people pitching a show to us. Within 5 minutes, I liked what I had heard. And I got up and I said, thanks, guys. I'll see you later. And I walked out. And if they wanted to carry on talking, they could. But I'd added I'd added the value I could add. I didn't need to know more. They'd explained themselves very well. So I saved, the way I see it, I saved 50 minutes.
No. You saved, how many people were in the meeting?
About six.
Okay, you saved 50 minutes times six.
No, because they carried on talking.
Okay, but that's their problem. You could have saved it. You could have said, hey, high five, we're done, and walked out the meeting.
Yeah.
But the problem comes in with the construct in the first place. So the legacy thinking is, hey, how long is a meeting? A meeting is an hour. So if I phone you, say, hey, man, I need a meeting to discuss something, we generally would put it in an hour. And I have this construct that says, well, hold on a second, there's an easy way to do this. I always turn around and say the same thing. And Taryn will say the same thing. Hey, oh, you'd like to see Rich. Fantastic. Okay, we can get you 15 minutes to see him tomorrow, half an hour to see him in 3 days, or an hour to see him in 2 weeks. Do you know how few people will take the hour? Very few. Now, some people will take the half hour in 3 days. But the idea is if you – and to me, the beautiful thing is –
most people will take the 15 minutes, right?
Right, because they want it done. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember if I mentioned the book. I think I did. But we sold a concept once to one of our clients where the idea was, hold on a second. Always sell batches of 2 15-minute meetings. So if you want to solve something, the problem is I'd go to a big corporation. Meetings take ages to put in, mostly because they invite too many people.
And then those people can't come and they move it and they move it.
Right.
Eventually it's December.
Right. So you know that take an hour. So I pitch an idea to you for a show. I get the whole team in there and I pitch an idea to you guys for a show. And it took time to get everyone together. Now you guys listen to that and you turn around, you give me some feedback and you say it's not really ideal and things like this. And then I've given you an hour. So I ask you, can I get another hour to present back again my findings? And then you say yes. And we all pull out our diaries and we check when we can all find an hour again. And a week and a half, 2 weeks later, you say, okay, we can find this. However, had I turned around and said to you, hey guys, I would like to have 2 15-minute meetings, one for you tomorrow morning, one this morning after the show,
mm-hmm.
and then one tomorrow morning after the show. And that's what I would like, just 2 15-minute meetings mm-hmm. after the show's on. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to come to you, and I'm going to pitch the idea of the show to you, my new show, and you're going to say, that's okay, but I don't like this, I do like this. And I'll say, cool, I'll see you tomorrow with a refined pitch. And then I walk back in the meeting tomorrow, and I present my refined pitch. I've only got 50 minutes, so we can't mess around making small talk, mm-hmm. and then I get it done. And that to me is a more efficient way. And then by then, it's still so fresh in your mind. You gave me the feedback yesterday. You've not, you know, it's
that. What about those people who say to you, again, I'm playing the devil's advocate here, but those people who say, well, you've got to spend some time talking shit with people. You've got to have the small talk.
Okay. Don't do that in a meeting. Have a lunch.
There we go. Oh, thank you.
Have a lunch. If you want to have, if I want to have a cup of coffee with you,
right.
I'm actually going to say to you, dude, I'd really like to just pick your brain about something. Do you mind if we go for a cup of coffee?
Uh-huh.
And then we can, and like a coffee is 45 minutes or a lunch is an hour and a half, which I've done with
you before. Talk some nonsense then.
And then we did get through nonsense and things and stuff, but then we also spent 30 minutes on the meat of the conversation. When you, me, and Ross went out, for example.
Right.
However, the contract being a social environment was that that was completely acceptable. However, if I invite all of you to sit in a meeting with me right now, I think it's abuse of the contract, of the purpose of the meeting. If we spend 45 minutes talking crap and 50 minutes talking about work,
Thank you.
I should have turned around and said to you, may I have 50 minutes of your time as a respect for everybody else in the room or everybody else's time?
I borrow something that you said often. And you've brought this up in a couple of reality checks and in conversation. And I think it's just such a useful thing that you've taken out of the games that you play, the board games. There's a lot that you've taken out of those that I think you implement and you talk about in your book as well. But I like the victory conditions discussion. You've often said to me, if you approach a problem or you go into a battle of ideas or anything else that's valuable as an expenditure of time, you need to know up front, what are the victory conditions? What do we want to achieve? This could count for meetings, for projects, for presentations, for just about anything. What are the victory conditions? And it's such a simple way for humans to go about their interactions because it immediately cancels out all the fluff around something. You go, I will know I have succeeded when 1, 2, 3 are achieved. And I use that all the time now.
Yeah, it refines your thinking. So what I like is the idea is that right now what we often start with is, and I often use the Standard Bank slogan, moving forward, as an example of the wrong way. We assume that moving forward is actually progressing. But moving forward is just moving in the same direction you were going, a step further. What to me is more important is moving toward. The problem is most people don't set out, they don't answer the question towards what. Mm-hmm. So they don't start off with the idea that this is where I'm trying to get to.
You don't know where you're going, anywhere will do.
Right, exactly. And forward will always be seen as progress. So every day you wake up and you do more of what you were doing yesterday and you check the boxes and everything feels right and it wasn't a bad day. So you think you're making progress. Except there's a point in, say, my company's history, there was a point in your career in radio where being better and better and better at a medium, every day you invested in the older medium, instead of investing in a new medium waiting for a technology to tip, was the wrong,
Well, it's called a medium because it's neither rare nor well done.
Exactly. I love that. And so for me, the having the victory condition was everything. Is the idea is, what is your condition of victory? The problem is, in most businesses, there is no end state. Mm-hmm. So in a board game, I can sit down with you guys and introduce you to a game and then we'll start playing. But the first thing I'm going to teach you is this is the end state. So we all know what we're playing for. We know the game ends when. And incidentally, you never play a board game, get to the victory condition and say, that was so much fun, let's keep going. You may say, let's start over again. What you'll usually say is, rad, that was amazing. What's next? What's the next game? And my problem in business is because we haven't defined victory, we go way, way past what we were trying to do in the first place, what we were trying to solve for, and we just keep on playing the game over and over and over again.
And this is also part of, and I think this might end up being one of those podcasts that people want to listen to when they work in a corporate environment and they're sick of the MBA talk. There's so much bullshit, stakeholder engagement, innovation, innovative design thinking. There's a lot of stuff that you don't actually need to vocalize. If you know the victory conditions, those things will happen anyway.
Right.
What I mean especially here is that there are a lot of people who talk about there's huge pressure to innovate, to be different, to stay ahead of the curve, blah, blah. You know these terms. It's a lot of claptrap. But those people are not necessarily doing what their business is there to do. If you make ladders, I don't really need you to innovate so much. I want you to make sturdy ladders. Sometimes people get caught up in trying to be Google or trying to be Instagram, when actually all we want them to do is to build tables or to make shelves or to make coffee. Sometimes that's enough. Sometimes we don't need you to innovate hugely in some of those businesses. Just keep refining in small increments what you do to make your product superior. But we don't need you to suddenly start making wings for humans to fly or giving us shoes that allow us to bounce instead of walk. Just sometimes do what you're good at.
Right. I guess where the I wouldn't say even counterpoint.
I don't want a bank to do too much innovation, if you know what I mean.
Well, the banks don't innovate. Even FNB, which is my hero, and they talk about, you know, they're the world's most innovative bank. No, they're a bank.
They were forced.
Innovates around the core.
But they were also forced to get there by the public who just demanded more.
Right, but in fairness, everybody was forced to get there, and only one rose to the challenge.
That's true.
And what they did is they changed the mindsets around belief in their teams around innovation, and I think that's important. But again, banking is banking. There's a fundamental aspect of a contract that we have. You know, look after my money, allow it to grow, keep it safe. You know, give me some advice on investing, help me purchase a house, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. And the innovation, I guess, with a shelf builder might come up with the fact that, well, I actually would like to be able to scan a photo of my wall, upload it to your server, and have you quote me instead of waiting for somebody to come around. Absolutely. So there's certainly ways that you can be innovative without innovating your entire core every time, because ultimately I still need to hang shit up in my lounge. And so that's what your shelf does, or I need a system to store more in the garage. Mm-hmm. Not everybody has to be seeking what is the next big thing. And in fact, I don't think they should. In corporates, for the most part, the biggest mistake corporates do is they chase this idea of being, you know, how can we innovate and how can we, but what they actually need to be comfortable with being is being the fastest follower. If you're a big bank or a big insurance company, it's one thing, you're probably not, in fact, I would say that you're certainly not going to reinvent insurance. Okay, now the sooner you understand that, the better. Instead of you trying to build a culture with, look at these cool little innovative startups we're funding and doing and things like this, what you need to turn around and say is, hey, when the change happens, we need to be ready. Yeah. You need to have your bags packed like a pregnant couple waiting for the baby to come. And you've got to sit there, and it's not about you. You're just waiting for the baby to arrive, and the moment the baby arrives, you take your bags. And the sheer mass of you that, to make a meaningful change with your client base and with all of these things will mean that you will be perceived as the innovator. But if they stop thinking about trying to, you know, create what will this look like, because they're too constrained with their old thoughts, unfortunately. That's not to say that they shouldn't be thinking in an innovative way. They should try to create a culture that fosters new ideas and allows new ideas to emerge. But they just need to be ready and be fast followers.
Do you think there is any way to change people's thinking in an academic sense? I mean, like, you hear a lot of people are doing this degree, or they're studying that at university, or they're in this business school, and they come out with varying qualifications, but they don't necessarily
know stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so now,
am I right?
Well, right, but let's call it what it is. Okay, so the reason everyone talks about
and you've got all these consultancy firms who they put out templates and then they change one or two things to make it look like they've tailor made it for that business, but these are people that you didn't employ. They're not working for you. You've brought them in because you don't know how to manage things. It's an admission of failure to bring those people in, as much as it's something that you sometimes do because you're out of ideas or you need some help.
Well, it's an admission of a lack of perspective. And I think that's critical, right? Is that sometimes it's hard to read the label from inside the bottle, and you get stuck in a certain idea of thinking. And often you just need somebody who's smart and who gets it to come in from the outside, to maybe look at and to try and solve your problem. Right. And I do think there is, these guys come in like the McKinsey's of the world, and they're amazing businesses, and they have these templates. I mean, they're presentation companies. They walk in and they wow you with an amazing theater and presentation, and they make everything sound amazing, and they tell you maybe what you've been thinking in your head, but they what's the word? And somebody gives you credibility for what you were thinking, or
it's confirmation bias.
Confirmation, right, exactly. Ah, I thought this, but now you've told me, and I've paid for this, therefore it must be true. But let's go back to the education thing quickly for a second, is that we need to understand a few things. A friend of mine, this guy, I think he's been on the show, Mark Sham. Has Mark been?
Yeah, we've had Mark on.
Right,
yeah.
So Mark and I mean, I really love what he's doing, but I disagree with one of his fundamental premises. Mm-hmm. And he says he wants to change education, and he's talking about the events. And I think you need to understand, if you want to change education, we've got to, if you really want to change the way, because we don't have an education problem. We have a people getting a job problem, which is as a result of a certification problem. So what we need to do is change the mindset altogether. Right now, it's not a case of, and again, I think I've maybe spoken to you about this before in Reality Check, when we had the fees must fall. Well, why are we trying to make university is very, very expensive because it's very long and cumbersome, and you're learning so many things and there's such a depth of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to make that cheaper and more affordable. But actually, the end game, the victory condition is not to have a degree. The victory condition is get an amazing job and look after our family. So why don't we try and make that more accessible? And the way we do that is we get the outmoded HR practices requiring a 4-year degree with mostly irrelevant topics just to prove that you're smart enough to get an interview so that you can start learning your job on the job. Mm-hmm. Now, again, not doctors, not lawyers, but for the most part, there's a degree of that that comes into play. So we need to change the certification model. The real legacy thinking in education for me is a certification problem. And we need to separate the act of education, learning stuff, from the act of certification, certifying you to get a job, to do a job for HR. Mm-hmm. Right? Because that's what your certification does. Oh, well, he's done an MBA. Therefore, he's done certain things. Therefore, we can hire him into this position. And that's just not, there has to be a better way to certify at this stage. And we're not changing that. And I think we could hack education altogether. I think your degree you should get your degree in a year. If you're doing a business degree, go to university, get your business degree in 1 year. But then you have to have 3 months of continued education every year in order to keep the letters behind your name. So let's get you out there and into the field faster, but let's make sure that you're relevant longer. Because the problem with education is we teach people still, we're actually lengthening the amount of time at the beginning of your career you have to learn stuff. Now, that is legacy thinking. That's unbelievable legacy thinking. Mm-hmm. We should be shortening the time you need to learn up front, and then we need to be extending the time you're actually learning throughout your life.
And updating.
And updating, right? Because later in life, what we have is a relevance problem. Because there's a point at which your salary is going up and up because of compounding, but your relevance is going down because the period of time between when you last learned and now. And because businesses are a pyramid, there's not space for everybody at the top of the food chain. All of a sudden, the people who cost you the most, who have the most dated information, they're lost and retrenched and changed. Mm-hmm. And the way that we can counter that is make sure that they also, the people with the most experience, also has the most, have the most relevant learning. Now, if it was up to me, I wouldn't try and change it from the ground down. I wouldn't be trying to change the way these new Khan Academies think. I mean, they're amazing, but what I would be trying to change is the way Harvard thinks. And I would say to them, okay, we will give you a degree from Harvard for free, but we tithe you. And we're going to take a tithe from your salary for the rest of your life. 2% of salary, 1% of your income generated for the rest of your life. We will take that to pay for your continued education, and we will educate you every single year. And you lose the letters behind your name the year you stop educating yourself, or maybe give you 1 year's grace. So don't get the corporations of education, the people who are most respected. You know, it still sounds great when you have Harvard behind your name.
Sure.
And change the way they think. Now, I've gone down a way big rabbit
hole. No, but I like this. You address the issue of entitlement, or rather your job title in the book too. You say that your job title means nothing.
Well, for sure, right?
Well, you said, you know, it comes from military thinking.
But I'm a cardiac surgeon, damn you. I mean, people take a lot of pride in being able to give themselves titles.
And those letters behind their names. Mm.
So I think I think we mustn't confuse occupation with title. Mm-hmm. Your occupation, you're a cardiac surgeon. That's what you do, mm-hmm. right? I'm a presentation strategist, but it doesn't say that on my business card.
If I say I'm the boss, that's not an important title.
Well, no, I think it is. I think you're the boss. I think the idea of the title is unimportant. But the idea that nobody here would confuse the fact that you are the boss and you're the visionary and you're the leader. But I also think that, for example, being a boss, sure, you can tell me if I'm fired or hired or things like that, but that's not going to get me to go to war for you. But the leadership title is one I bestow upon you. So I see you as a thought leader. I like the way you think about things. In fact, I want to – don't ever turn – Gareth Cliff, if you ever turn around and say again, I'm not clever, but I'm actually going to ride in here in my motorcycle. We all know you're clever. You're one of the smartest mofos I've ever met in my entire life. You don't get to sit in an interview with anyone and say you're not clever. I mean, he's a smart guy, right?
I know. It's so patronizing to other people. I get it.
It is because you are so
smart.
Shut up,
smart. Ben. Shut up. How
like
dare
he always
you?
Goes, oh, when someone looks as curmudgeonly as me, it's a very good looking person.
Yeah. I mean, look, yeah. You're super smart. Anyway, I just remember that when I was riding in, I was like, what? I was going to stop and phone, pull over my motorbike.
You say that there's a fallacy of best.
Yes.
The legacy thinking there is be the best.
Right. So there's, I guess, two parts to this thing. So being the best. If I asked you, what is the best band of all time or the best music album of all time? Oh, we could debate it. And people in the audience always throw out these different answers to me. And I said, cool, cool, cool. And then I said, but when's the last time you listened to them? Yeah. And they're like, well, geez, I don't know, at a wedding sometime. And if I said to them, what's the best restaurant in South Africa? Oh, maybe Test Kitchen and Cape Town or this or that next thing. Cool. How often do you go? Maybe once, you know, in a blue moon, once every year in an anniversary. But if I turn around to you and say to you, well, hold on. And so we're all trying to be best because we think best is important. The problem is best is quite difficult to measure and we actually don't use it that much. But if I turn around to you and say to you, well, hold on a second, what's the favorite? What's your favorite band?
Yeah.
I mean, you guys know because I'm always trying to get you to play Rise Against. Rise Against is my favorite band.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's no debate here. You can't tell me I'm wrong. You can tell me you don't like Rise Against. I completely respect that. But the truth is, if you ask me when I last listened to Rise Against, it was yesterday afternoon because it came on my favorite playlist. If you ask me what my favorite restaurant is Ghazal, the curry house in Peter Place. Now, again, you don't get a vote. You don't get a vote on whether it's my favorite or not. And if you ask me how often I go to Ghazal, if we turn around and said, hey, let's go out for a dinner, I would always throw Ghazal into the mix and we'd go grab a curry there.
It's a good joint.
Great curry.
Right. Okay. So can we do a curry there one day?
Yes,
we have a show over curry.
I love that place.
And, but that's the thing is favorite I go to a lot. And what I realized is that the premise of being best, the rules for best and the rules for favorite are fundamentally different. So if you want to be the best at something, you know, it's a whole way of thinking. But if you want to be somebody's favorite, and the way I start with, work out then, if you're going to be somebody's favorite, you have to be willing to be somebody's worst. Okay? You cannot be anybody's favorite anything if you're not somebody else's worst something. So I don't mind if I go into a room and 1% of the room says, I hate that guy. He should never be given a microphone. How dare he swear? And, you know, how I will be totally offended that he said fuck, yet I'll go home and I'll watch American Pie and giggle because I'm unable to context shift smartly. But I don't mind. I don't mind that they hate me. I think that's okay. I don't mind polarizing anyone because I have to be somebody's worst place. to go to. You know, I have to be something that somebody would never go, because then I've got a chance of being somebody else's favorite. But if you're not upsetting anyone, if you're not pissing anyone off, you can never be anybody's favorite anything. You'll only ever be okay and average. And I actually take personal offense to that. The people in the market for boring are spoiled for choice.
But isn't it also very egotistical to expect to be liked by everyone?
Well,
I mean, that's not possible.
I don't think it is possible.
You're not going to be everyone's favorite.
No, you wouldn't be everybody's favorite.
Get over yourself.
I always say to people, Nelson Mandela had detractors. You're not Nelson Mandela. Barack Obama had detractors. There are a lot of people who think that he was a shitty president, despite the fact that many of us think he was great.
Yeah.
So if they can't do it, who the hell do you think you are?
Right. And the problem is, though, is that when we go to – if you go into the average corporate business meeting – and in fact, I want to just I'm using the term corporate, meaning a big company. Mm. But I only deal with corporate companies. Yeah. And the most innovative people I know are sitting in those businesses, often frustrated.
Yeah.
So I'm by no means saying that people – and I feel it's important to kind of mention that. It's just very, very hard to turn that big ship. So it's often a big challenge. But we'll be sitting there with these guys, and then they'll say, because maybe they don't have permission, oh, well, somebody won't like this. So let's take the advert for – I mean, it was just stupid. The insurance advert that ran.
Oh, the one that caused all the controversy.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, maybe –
I haven't seen it, by the way.
Oh, I never saw it, 'cause I think it was taken off. But it was like, I get the basic premise. They bought a canned advert and they ran it, and you know, it was not representative, and it was a really stupid idea. But for the most part, bizarrely, and I'm not saying this is right, but there's a whole bunch of people in this country who think, yes, finally my, you know, I'm, this is what I want to see, for right or for wrong. So even if you've pissed off somebody, somebody else thinks you're doing a good job. Huh. I once answered this tweet to this American rapper, and I still get included in things around a topic. And it's amazing, because I took a slight opinion in one way, and the people who are standing up for me, I'm more polarized from them than from anybody else. But yeah, there's always a counterpoint to opinion. And I think that what we should be striving to be is to be somebody's favorite something. And to be okay then with the idea that, well, if I'm going to be somebody's favorite, if you're going to be somebody's favorite station, right? You have to have decided who your audience isn't. And in fact, it's an easier starting point. Instead of trying to think, well, who do we want to get? What should we say to get them? It's actually much easier to say, who do we not want? Mm-hmm. How do we, I mean, I hate to say it, but how do we offend them that they would never want to listen?
Mm.
And then what you'll find is the act of doing that will push all the people who have that similar, all the people who have that similar point of view, you know, that will unite them.
I love it. It's very difficult for people to do that kind of thing, though, because they try to please everybody. We like to please other people. We like to make people feel better. We like to make them feel good, and we like to include as many as possible. Because that's also, to some people, it's a measure of success, right?
Yeah, but the first thing is make sure you please yourself. And I know that this sounds maybe – but if you can turn around and say, well, I want to create something that I'm happy with, and just use that as a template, because it's the only thing you know the answer to. It's the only thing you know that, well, okay, I'm going to create a business that runs the way I want it to run. And I hope somebody else will believe in that ideal. But if you're constantly caught up trying to guess how other people think, mm-hmm. you're just hamstrung from the start. So the idea is to
that
create something that's your best version.
It's
absolutely. Now, don't get me wrong. I do care. I do get upset when people say I'm an arsehole and an idiot and things like this. And of course, you have feelings in these things, but I don't let it change my path. I don't let it turn around and change the way I'm doing things, because I'm worried about one person. That's why I'm not politically correct.
Now, what about these people? This is a chapter you deal with in here. Brand building, schmand building. You say your logo is your brand. That's the legacy thinking. But I meet people who nobody knows who they are. They've never done anything noteworthy. I might be horrible here, but let's say they've just started out in their career. So they don't really have a lot to go on. There isn't a brand. No one sees them and thinks, oh, that's what they stand for. Those are the things that they mean. This is the kind of space they occupy. Nobody knows anything about them, but they talk about their brand. Now, that's a good way to think about the world, because you could build your brand. And if you have some idea of what your brand is, you've got to start somewhere, right? It's particularly if you're going to be a public person.
No.
But what do you think of this? Tell me why that's wrong.
Okay, so the first thing is, when you're referring to, if you're talking about the concept of brand conceptually in the third person, mm-hmm. if I'm talking about branding or a brand, that, you know, when there's not something specific, then the word brand makes sense. But if I'm talking about cliffcentral.com, then there's no need to use the term. It's like me saying the Gareth Cliff person, right? There's no, I don't understand the qualifier. There's just Gareth Cliff. Your brand is who you are as a person, right? And all my opinions, your brand is the bank of opinions I have, the corner of real estate you own in my brain. Before I met you, your brand in my head was angry guy on Idols. Well, okay, and so this is how I understood it. But then luckily, next to you was a guy I liked less. I remember I used to laugh at Conrad Cox's famous joke, "Don't you wish Gareth Cliff would jump off his old own surname?" And I thought, yes, I do. And then I met you, and then I realized, wait a minute, this guy's my hero. Well, actually, first thing, I read your book, and I was like, I love the way this guy thinks. This guy thinks that we're similar in our thinking, in that we think about different things in different ways. And then I met you, and then I understand this different thing. So my brand for you has changed, right? So that brand, no amount of logo or any device that you have will change the corner of real estate that you have in my head. Cliff Central's brand is the conversations that this team has when I listen on my motorbike, and when I listen to the conversations you have, that's your brand. You could change your logo tomorrow and it would make no difference to me, because your brand will continue being what your brand is. What you mean, the brand is the way, the imprint in my brain of what it means when I hear the term Cliff Central. And that to me is what we should be focusing on. And the reason I worry about logo devices as a brand is that I think it makes you think, it's like, put on expensive jeans and act like an asshole. You're still an asshole. I don't care what jeans you're wearing. But we need to work on not being the asshole. So if we're a company, we want to build a brand. So in Missing Link, I turned around to my guys and said, okay, we're operating without a safety net. Missing Link will never, ever, ever have a fixed corporate identity. We do not have a logo. We have never had a logo. Any guy at any given time can create a new device and represent it that way. Because then what they have to be mindful, when they don't have that safety net, they have to be mindful that the way that they act when they're in front of a customer, the customer experience that they get when they're dealing with us, that is our brand, not our logo. So I don't want to have that net to fall on. Now, I don't think this is a strategy we should all abide by. I do think it's important. Human Rights, my notebook company, has a brand. I don't think it's something that's the better vehicle or has a CI, but I think it's important to understand the differentiation, that if you want to change your company's brand, that doesn't mean changing the logo and bending the corners. I mean, the banks, they literally bend the corner of their logo around and then they do a roadshow launching their new brand. I mean, come on, guys. Come on. How can you even hear yourself?
Tell me about that story that you mentioned in the book, the Apple cooling fans.
Okay, so I'm in the Creativity World Forum, one of the greatest events I've ever been to in my life. It's in Antwerp. I highly recommend for people who like creative thinking, not like ad creative people. It's just one of the speakers was a guy called Steve Wozniak, the Woz. Mm-hmm. And he tells his story, and it was way back when Apple had a problem where their computers were overheating. And what they used to do is put in these fans.
Yeah.
The fans would make a big noise and all of these things. And at one stage, one of the developers came up with this idea that he could use this kind of heat sink cable-y type stuff, whatever it was, and Apple could actually take the fans out of their computer because the cable dissipated its heat along the journey, and the vents that they had allowed the heat to dissipate, so they didn't need fans anymore. And Steve Jobs was like, this is a major innovation. You don't have that silly fan noise. This is beautiful. We're going to never have fans in our computers again. And this was fantastic. And they went and created the world's first fanless computer. Uh-huh. And then they followed it generation after generation. You actually see in the photos, the computer's getting smaller and everything's amazing. But then what happened is we reached a problem where the heatsink cable was no longer powerful enough to deal with the process in the increased processor. So it got to the point, though, because Apple had defined itself by not having fans, it ended up having to make bigger computers, or it ended up not following maybe some of the innovations or putting in some of the bigger processes they could have done, because they couldn't solve the problem about how do we keep fans out of computers.
So the ability to not have a fan in there became more important than...
Right, because they defined themselves by the fact that we are the computer that has no fans. And this went on and on and on, until one day Wozniak walked into a meeting with Jobs and turned around and said, wait a minute, Steve, are we in the business of fanless computers, or are we in the business of small, sexy devices that get things done the best possible way? And Steve Jobs realized, wait a minute, of course that's what we're in the business for. Because the understanding was, the problem about the big, fat, original fans in the first place There was an iteration from it, and I actually talk about this concept in the book as well, this bad first iteration. The fan companies, when they were kicked out of Apple, they didn't turn around and say, oh, well, we're just going to stop innovating. You know, we're just going to accept it. Okay, you win. Computers don't need fans. They said, well, there's a problem. Fans are too big and too noisy. So they went away and they were innovating these small, beautiful, sexy little fans that you would hardly hear that did their job really, really well. So the original problem had gone. But Steve Jobs wasn't willing to get out of the idea that computers shouldn't have fans in them. And it was only when he turned around and he said, hold on, look, we can build a smaller, sexier computer using a fan that you will not hear. So why are we against it? And now, of course, Apple computers have fans again, because that's the way that that's the innovation. But the legacy thinking is, well, we do not have fans. But the real thinking was, what are we trying to achieve? What's the victory condition?
Do you like it when people talk about thinking outside of the box? Because that's another nice catchphrase that people.
I mean,
like,
I actually definitely have addressed this as on a reality check segment before. Think outside the box is a problem. I think you just don't have enough boxes. I don't think we should be trying to think outside the box. I think we need more boxes to draw from. And that's why I try to learn from more different types of people. Why the stream of things in my Twitter feed is not just people who agree with me. It's people with polarized opinions. It's people with points of view that I fundamentally disagree with. Because it forces me to learn different things and to have multiple opinions. And what I've found that almost every problem that I need to solve, another different aspect, I can draw on the way I behave on a motorcycle and dealing with traffic as a way of solving a business problem. Mm-hmm. I can draw on, so the more different inputs I have, the more different areas where I'm actually trying to learn and achieve, not mastery in, but learn more of, I think, the better. And I think actually we shouldn't be trying to think outside the box. I think we should just have lots and lots of boxes to think within. And I also feel, incidentally, that sometimes having a box, having a constraint is a good thing. We need freedom within a framework. Creativity isn't about having any given idea. It's about having the best possible idea within the constraints of what you're trying to achieve.
You said something very obvious in this book that I needed to take you on about. On page 97, you say, and you actually put it in inverted commas like it's profound.
Did I?
You said, the magic of a book is in its words.
Right. And I was saying...
No, explain it.
Okay.
It's not as stupid as it sounds when I say it.
Right. And the idea was that when people turn around and say to me, now I read books, I've got a book with pictures on it and I wanted something to look nice on a shelf. And the only way that I could justify having a printed book is if I had pictures in it or something that you could draw on. Because for the most part, when I'm reading it, listening to either book, either in audio or on my Kindle. And people always turn around and they say to me, oh no, but you know, I just love the smell of the book. The magic of a book is in its pages and the feel of the paper. You're doing it wrong. For goodness sake, man. It's the words that matter. Like I don't care how you read it. It could be your entire book could be written in billboards that you drive past on your way to work. You're trying to learn. It's just a medium for delivering data and information. The magic is not the words. It's not about the book. It's not about the tome that you're holding in front of you. It's about the fact that there's a sharing of knowledge. And I think that we need to understand that. So we need to be okay with the fact that Kindles are not killing off reading and they're not making it worse. And
You're upsetting the purists.
Yeah, but the purists need to understand that again, what is the hobby here? Is the hobby taking in things and drawing pictures in your brain because the words provoke a mindset within yourself to try and imagine things? Or is it about holding a dead tree that you can flip through?
Okay. What do you say here that there's legacy thinking around the color of your credit card correlates to your wealth?
Yeah. So that was a thing I just found out by accident way back when. You know, when you have a gold card, and a gold card means, hey, look, this guy's quite wealthy, or a black card means he's even wealthier. So I didn't realize, and we still have those today.
Is that still true?
Yeah.
Well, it's still a perception, right? Okay. If you see somebody whip out a gold card, you kind of think, there's a perception there.
Okay.
Now, the funny thing was, is where I found this out is one of my staff years ago went to a guy called Ross. He went to a bank, and when they asked him what card he wanted, and it was one of the banks, you could get like a picture of you on a skateboard or things like this. And he said, I'd like the gold one. And they're like, sweet. And he said, can I get that? And he said, yeah, this is just plastic. So I thought, wait, well, where does this come from then? Well, it turns out way back when, the idea was that remember you used to have those credit card machines, you put your card in and it went, and you swiped it back and forward. Well, so what happened is, how does the merchant know how much money you're good for? There has to be some sort of guarantee process. So the bank made that easy. They turned around and said, hey, if you've got a normal color card, you're good for $100, whatever the number was. But if you've got a silver card, we'll guarantee it for $500. Like, this guy's got a silver card, we'll guarantee, it's safe for you to process that card, you've got a bank guarantee for $500. And if you've got a gold card, you've got a bank guarantee for $1,000.
Yeah.
And, you know, the black card, that famous, was it Diners Club Black, was like unlimited. So the idea was the card itself would tell the merchant what the bank guarantee was. And then it was the idea of if you're swiping a silver card and you're trying to do 550 rand, I don't know if you remember the old days where they said, I need to call for authorization. And yes. they would pick up the call and they would do it. Now, the legacy is that we still have the perception that a gold card means something special when in fact the utility of that idea has gone completely. There is no utility anymore. The color of your card means absolutely nothing other than the perception of what it is. But it actually started with, I think, quite an interesting and elegant. It was an elegant solution to a problem around, hey, how does the merchant know how much money you're good for?
And the banks definitely still play into us being idiots in that way, because they'll still send you notifications. You now qualify for the platinum card. Da 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 da. It's like, okay.
Oh, look at you, Mubs. You get those emails?
The banks still do that. I'm telling you.
Right. She sounds saying that.
Yeah.
they do. So,
but of course they do. And why do you think they do it?
Because they're feeding into...
Because it works.
Well, there you go. That's why I say they keep playing into our stupidity in the way that we think.
But, there's a reason. I mean, let's talk about how stupid we are. There's a reason that, you know, you'll never accidentally find... You'll always find my my RMB black card at the top of my wallet. You'll rarely find my Discovery Medical Aid card. Now, theoretically, yes, there's a practicality. That's the card I go for the most.
Yeah.
But there's also the idea that, well, that's the kind of card that defines a status. And so I banked with two banks. I banked with Investec and RMB. And I canceled the one because I didn't want a big picture of a big zebra on my card. And like it actually bothered me. And I felt like when I was throwing it out there, and again, this is their brand and this is their thing.
It's like this guy who he pretty much brought television to South Africa. He said that in the beginning, they used to get a lot of calls from women who said, look, I like the TV, but can we please have pictures on it that match my lounge?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a great way to think of things.
Right. And I guess there is some degree of that. So the reason the banks still do it is that it works. But I just quite like the idea of understand you should be, if you want to question something, you have to understand the problem we're solving in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the core premise.
Victory condition.
The core premise of the book is very simple. When you start out doing something, you're setting out to solve a problem. At some stage, you solve that problem and things become a bit easier because you've actually figured out what it is. You've figured out what the solution is. And then you're going to go into phase two of your business, which is refining your solution. How can I refine my solution so it makes more money, so I can get it out smoother, so we can do it at scale? What are all these processes? And then at some point, and everything's working better, you're making more money. But then you get to a point where there's actually a problem because now we're in the solution refinement, but it doesn't feel effective anymore. And then the idea is, well, hold on a second. It comes back to that idea is, well, is the problem, does it still work? And that's it. And you have to be mindful of, should we still be doing this? Well, what problem are we trying to solve with it? And if you understand what the people were trying to solve in the first place, it makes it so much easier to let go of old ideas because you can actually high five it. You can give old ideas the best retirement party ever. You can say, this was amazing. You did exactly what you set out to do. High five to that idea. That idea should have a poster on the wall of what it achieved. We should tell the world what we achieved with that idea, put it to rest and do something new. But we don't.
Do you have any criticism for...
Lots.
for the value that people place in family names, you know, when it comes to that aspect of legacy. You know, like, I am... descended from the Trumps or whatever. My father before me and his father before him and so on and so on started this business and you are my son and you will continue the family name. I mean, what do you say about stuff like that?
I mean, one of the things, I'm Scottish, and one of the things I'm most upset about is, I mean, I've got an Irish surname, and I don't have a clan and a tartan. So bizarrely, it's not that I don't love history. I mean, I'm absolutely love history and idea of tradition, but I also understand what it is. For me, it's an idea, and I like, we have an extremely close-knit family, and I love the idea that draws us together. Incidentally, it's not a surname because the Osbornes and the Hattings are as much a part of the family as the Mulhollands. You know, it's an extended clan. So I don't buy into that old idea, and I certainly don't buy into the idea of that you must continue your thinking and you must follow a certain construct. But I love the idea. I love the idea of names and traditions. But I equally love the idea of, for example, you know, in Iceland, they don't follow our method. They follow a patronymy.
Yeah, you are Gustav Olafsson.
Yes, so your father Callum is Olaf. Yeah. Callum Richardson. And
exactly.
And
so
Bailey,
the surname
is,
Richardson just means your dad was Richard, yeah, not that
Callum Richards Dottier.
Right.
And that's how the names work. And in fact, one of my favorite things is because of that, it makes it complicated to know who you're banging. So they actually in Reykjavik, so first of all, small city and nobody knows the surname. So you don't know if you're shagging your cousin. So they actually have an app. No. And also it's a society that's so free around sexuality that they promote, you know, and the term promiscuous is wrong. No, they promote the idea that there should be. So it's the only place you'll ever go in your life where there's absolutely no stigma around, it does not exist. The concept of that a woman could be a slut and the guy in a stud, that idea simply does not hold true. They can't fathom.
That's my next holiday destination.
So they cannot fathom how you could perceive that. Mm. So if you want to go out and you're a lady and you want to sleep with a guy, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
You're a lady, come and sleep with me.
Right, but they will walk up to you and
talk like that about things.
Yeah. And but the because of this, they understand that sexuality is what sexuality is, so they want to make it easy. So they actually have an app and a register that when you meet somebody in a nightclub, but I mean, it's a perfectly feasible thing.
And it gives you a green light or
yeah, it tells you like good to go, my friend. and it's a thing because it's a register that exists. But because they're so, this is what they had to do. But I love the idea, incidentally, and I think we may have mentioned this before, but I love the idea as well that they say, by all means, come and live in Iceland. We love that you would come here. Oh, but you've arrived in Iceland and your name is Hamish McTavish and you're having a child and you want to name your child Bob McTavish. Unacceptable. If you're living in Iceland, oh, we understand that we respect your traditions and things. Yes, you're different. Cool. Stay there. But if you come to us, then your kid's name it will be like Bob McHamish, right? Bob Hamishson. You need to follow our rules and traditions because that's what we're doing. Yeah. And you need to learn the language. If you can't learn to speak like an Icelander, then don't come to Iceland. Right, so this is not for you. So they respect the idea that you can have any idea and anything and any way of thinking about anything.
My belly still wants to go.
No, I said for a holiday destination. I'm not going to move there.
No, it's the number one. Everybody in the world needs to. It's one of the. I've only been to two places in the world that feel fundamentally different. That allows me to look at the world through new eyes. It actually feels like you're going to a different place. And the one is Reykjavik, and the other is Tokyo. Yeah. And if you can go to Reykjavik and just perceive and understand the way there. In fact, they're the opposite, though. They're holding on to a bunch of legacies, and they're totally happy to say that, well, we think about things in a certain way. And, okay, you can say we're wrong, but incidentally, they were the first, you know, they were the fastest rebounding economy after the global crash, because when everybody bailed out their banks, they were like, this is the stupidest thing. Wait a minute. These idiots, hold on. These idiots, talk about legacy thinking. These guys completely screwed us all. I mean, they properly shafted us for their own gain, and they destroyed the global economy, and now you're saying that we must take our money
and put it back.
And put it back into them so that they can continue.
Not having.
Are you cooked?
Yeah.
What's wrong with you? They said absolutely not. We're not bailing out any of them. They sent most of them to prison. I mean, they only have 50 people in prison at any given time. They come home for the weekends. But they send them to prison, and then they rebuilt the banking structure, and they were the fastest rebounding economy in the world. Because they said, well, hold on a second, that broke it. Don't bring that back. That's stupid. It's the same way I feel about the bailout of SAA. Stop. If it's not functioning,
let it fall.
Let evolution run its course.
Yeah, we let fees fall. We let roads fall. We let all kinds of things that we know are outdated fall. SAA must fall.
Right. And you know what will come out of it? The phoenix that will rise will be a new, better run airline, national carrier. Incidentally, I'm okay with even keeping to some degree it as a national carrier, as an international. If they separated SAA into two businesses, domestic and international, to some degree, I'm okay with having a national flag carrier and us helping and fly that way, and they should be competitive. But what I'm absolutely against is how dare we bail out a domestic carrier that has other domestic businesses competing. Mm-hmm. So we've got these entrepreneurial run businesses that are trying their best to build something meaningful here to be create competition, and then we're using our tax money to make it difficult for them by constantly bailing out a government run
supporting
because it's a flag carrier.
A non-competitor.
Yeah, we don't need to have a national pride internally.
Listen, I could talk to you for hours, and I suspect a lot of people would want to. No, your book is terrific. It's called Legacide, Why Legacy Thinking is the Silent Killer of Innovation. Rich Mulholland, thank you so much for coming to see us. And
thanks, team.
Yeah, thanks, man. Well, he's kind of part of the furniture here. It's
I miss being in the studio.
No. It's nice. You should try that every Monday. You're always in Cape Town or in Reykjavik or in some other fancy and exotic place. Thank you, man.
Thanks, guys. Right,
there you go. The book's called Legicide. Check it out. And I think it's probably the kind of thing that if you want your kids to really think differently, this is probably something that you should give them for Christmas.
This is CliffCentral.com.